All day, Jeff listened carefully. Finally, about mid-afternoon, he got what he was after. At the water barrel, he overheard one rebel lieutenant tell another that Steele and his 1,500 Texans had just arrived, and with Steele in command, all the rebels would soon move northward to Prairie Springs, 15 miles east of Fort Gibson, to await the arrival from Red River of a brigade of Texas cavalry under General Smith R. Bankhead. Then they would all move together against the fort. Eager now to take the news to Blunt, Jeff made his plans. He saddled the dun. During supper, he hid 2 large chunks of cooked beef in his haversack and several large sweet potatoes. He felt mean about deceiving Heifer. Heifer had been good to him. When the rebels discovered him gone, it might go hard with Heifer. But this was war, and Jeff had a job to do. The dun was fresh. When darkness came, he would just ride off, heading northward up the Texas road. The violent stomach pains struck him as he was filling his canteen from the water barrel. Nauseated, he reeled blindly against a wagon wheel. He didn't know what ailed him. He had never felt like this in his life before. Surely it was just a sudden cramp that would pass. But the stomach pains kept coming, hard and relentlessly. He felt suddenly cold, then hot. Heifer found him crouched against the wagon, so dizzy he could hardly walk. The big cook picked Jeff up and carried him bodily to his bunk. Quivering with cold, Jeff pulled a blanket over himself and lay still, his mind in turmoil. He had to get through to Blunt right away. Any delay would be ruinous, jeopardizing Fort Gibson and the lives of thousands. Unable to find any quinine, Heifer came back and dosed Jeff with a foul-tasting tea he brewed from dogwood bark. Jeff began to sweat and threw off his blanket. He was burning up. Panting, he felt as though he could drink gallons of cold water. Like a distraught father, Heifer hovered constantly over him. Finally, he left again to hunt for the ingredients for what he called his iron medicine, made by dropping several rusty nails into a bottle of water.
"If you drink it, you'll have plenty of iron in your blood," he told Jeff.
Jeff watched him go and, feeling his chills subsiding slightly, crawled to his feet and staggered over to the dun. It took nearly all his remaining strength to gain the saddle. A sentry stopped him, saw he was sick, and let him pass. The dun's galloping jarred him so much that he slowed the horse to a walk. He felt so weak that twice he almost fell off. He would never make it to Fort Gibson. He would be lucky if he made it back to camp. How was he going to warn Blunt? He saw a church in the distance. The church where he had met Lyman Jones. Hancock Mission, Lyman had called it. He remembered Lyman lived half a mile down the road there. Groggy, Jeff walked the dun until he came to a big, well-kept farm set back against the woods. It was growing dark. Several slave cabins stood in the open clearing. He saw Lyman Jones in a corral milking a cow. Desperate, he decided to be thoroughly honest. He knew it was risky, but it was a chance he had to take. Orff had told him once that all scouts had to take lots of chances. Jeff laid it on the line.
"Lyman, I'm not a rebel. I'm a Union scout from Fort Gibson. I've got an important message for General Blunt at the fort. I'm too sick to deliver it myself. I want you to take my horse and gun and go in my place. I've got food packed in my haversack here. You said you knew a shortcut. Will you go?"
The young Negro's eyes gleamed proudly.
"I sure will.
I can be back in 2 days if they give me a fresh hoss at the fort. Or maybe I'll stay there and join the colored regiment you told me about."
His face fell momentarily.
"But I sure hates to leave my old mammy and my dog."
Jeff waited for him while he hurried inside to tell his mother goodbye. Soon Lyman came gliding back.
"Yes, sir. Now, what's the message?"
Jeff decided to have him memorize it. Then if he was captured, they wouldn't find any dispatch. Keeping the information brief, Jeff told Lehman twice and had Lehman repeat it back to him each time. The Negro leaped up behind him and, reaching both arms around Jeff, steered the dun and held Jeff on at the same time. Using a shortcut to avoid the rebel sentries, he returned Jeff close to the rebel camp. Dismounting, Lehman lifted Jeff out of the saddle.
"Good luck," breathed Jeff,
and felt the cold chills coming back. He wished with all his heart he was going to. Lehman's white teeth gleamed in the dusk.
"I'll make it," he said.
He swung easily, lithely, into the saddle. Puzzled, the dun curved his graceful neck around to look at Jeff. He nickered softly as if asking, "What's going on here?" Jeff reached out feebly, grasping the animal's black mane with one hand and giving him a couple of pats.
"Tell them at the fort I said to take good care of my horse until I get back. Tell them to salt and water him often," he charged.
The Negro nodded and dug his bare heels into the horse's flanks. A minute later, the dusk swallowed them. Chapter 20 The Jackmans. The big four-poster bed was soft and comfortable. Jeff's head still felt heavy on the pillow, but his fever was gone, and for the first time in days he could think clearly. He opened his eyes wider and saw it was late afternoon and that he was lying in bed in somebody's house. Looking down at his legs, he could scarcely believe they were his. They looked thin and emaciated instead of hard and wiry, and he could see his ribs showing above the pair of clean white drawers somebody had drawn on him. A Negro woman, huge and billowy, her shining blue-black hair bound in a red handkerchief, waddled into the room, wheezing heavily at every step. Weakly, Jeff jerked the sheet up over his bare legs and midriff.
"Hey, now!" she cackled in a strong, lusty contralto that rang through the hall like a man's. "You got your eyes open for the first time since you got here."
When she opened her vast mouth to grin at him, her teeth reminded Jeff of a row of white piano keys. Her friendliness made him feel good all over. He opened his eyes wider and saw he was in a large room with a highly arched ceiling. In all his life, he had never seen a bedroom as nice as this. The walls were stained blue, and there were pictures on them. There was a rag rug of red and blue upon the polished brown floor. But the floor seemed farther away than it should be. At first, Jeff thought it was his head swimming again, until he slid his chin over the side and saw that the bed was elevated. There was a dresser in the corner, and nearby stood two handmade chairs with half-spindle backs. The room even had a fireplace. From the open window, yellow curtains ballooned toward him. Propelled by the slow breeze, everything was clean as a pin.
"How long have I been here, ma'am?"
Jeff breathed and was surprised at the physical effort it cost him to speak.
"Oh, we're about 2 weeks."
"What's the matter with me?"
Rolling her eyes in fear, she wrapped her heavy black arms nervously in her blue apron.
"Honey, when they first brought you here, you looked all flaxed out and dead on divine. You had the flesh creeps and the shivery shakes, then it went into the wee-wahs, then you got the heaves every time we fed you. You done swallow your food."
Jeff stirred restlessly on the pillow. He had never heard of any of those diseases. He wished she wouldn't talk so loudly. She made his head ache. She went on excitedly.
"You even took spells where you'd get unnoodled and queer in the head. When we bathed you, you'd call me Mama and Bessie and Mary and Lucy. And, honey, when you'd call me Lucy, you'd say the sweetest things."
Again she broke into a wild cackle of laughter. In spite of his pallor, Jeff blushed. If, in his delirium, he had talked freely about his family and about Lucy, what had he said about himself? Had he also divulged that he was a Union scout? There was no sign of it in her beaming countenance. From the buxom Negro, whose name was Hannah, and who told him she had come from Louisiana on a steamboat, Jeff learned he was staying at the home of the Jackmans, a wealthy rebel family living north of the Canadian River near Briartown. Heifer had brought him here in a commissary wagon, and Colonel Wadey had personally sent a message to Mrs. Jackman, whom he called Aunt Maggie, asking her to take Jeff in until he recovered. With no hospital available, it was the custom to billet sick soldiers with friendly civilian families. With one hand, Jeff pushed his scraggly hair out of his eyes and felt a little ashamed. He found it hard to identify Wadey the raider with the Wadey who had found him a princely refuge like this. Laboriously, he turned from his left side to his right in the big bed. He didn't understand it. He wondered if Lehman Jones had made it through to Fort Gibson with his messages for Blunt. Hannah left and came back presently with Mrs. Jackman, mistress of the home. She was small and prematurely gray, with a high forehead and a determined little twist of mouth. Her gray eyes were so wise and knowing that Jeff felt a twinge of panic, wondering if she were on to his masquerade. But she smiled cordially, saying, "Welcome to our home, sir. How are you feeling?" Jeff managed a wan smile. "Kind of peaked, ma'am. And kind of embarrassed, too. I've never been sick a day in my life before. I don't know how to thank you, ma'am, for taking me in like this. I know I've been lots of trouble to everybody." She placed a cool hand on his forehead. "Nonsense, Mr. Bussey. You've been no trouble at all. We've enjoyed having you. I've never seen a worse case of malaria, but your fever seems to have subsided. Before long, I hope, we'll be able to send you back to stand, well and strong." Smiling shyly, the rest of the family came into the room and were introduced. There were five of them, all girls. Like Lucy Washburn, each had the same brownish cast of skin that denoted their Cherokee blood. They were black-haired, with high foreheads and small mouths, and shrewd, intelligent eyes like their mothers. When one laughed, they all laughed, and with the same soprano inflection. Marjorie and Sophie, the oldest, were married and had husbands in the rebel army and infants at home. Then there was Jill, 18, Janice, 16, and Patricia, 13, who wore boots and a riding habit. She looked like the tomboy of the family. The following day was Sunday, and Jeff was awakened very early by a feminine voice calling insistently from outside his window.
"Mr. Davis! Mr. Davis!"
Whoever was calling was trying to do it quietly, but wasn't succeeding very well. And she was mistering him by his second name, not his last name. Jeff winked his eyes sleepily open and looked out into the cool flush of early morning. The east was oranged over with daybreak. A cowbell jangled down in the barn lot, and he knew the cattle were getting up and stretching themselves. The insect drone had died to a small, tremulous murmur. It seemed that the whole world was just waking up and throwing off the covers.
"Mr. Davis! Mr. Davis!"
Standing bareheaded in the wet grass, an excited smile on her face, was Patricia. Her brown hair fell in a long braid down her back. Her boots were wet and had strands of wet green grass plastered to them. She was holding by the bridle reins a beautiful black colt with a red quilt strapped to his back. Young and irresponsible as his mistress, the colt was hungrily nibbling Marjorie's beloved hyacinths from the flower bed beneath the window.
"This is my horse, Barney," the girl told Jeff. "Watch him go."
She led him over to a wooden horse block and mounted from a flying leap. The instant she hit the red quilt, Barney broke fast like an arrow from a bow. In a dozen quick strides, he was galloping full tilt across the dewy Cherokee countryside. The girl rode as if she were glued to him, her brown pigtail floating horizontally behind. After she had ridden 100 yards, she turned him and cantered back to Jeff's window, her face beaming blissfully. The colt was panting gently. Jeff put his arms on the windowsill.
"Where's your saddle?"
he asked her, trying to keep his voice low so he wouldn't awaken the household.
"I'd rather ride him this way,"
Miss Patricia confided with a frank grin.
"That's why I get up early and ride. Mama doesn't like for me to ride without a saddle. So just before she wakes up, I go saddle him."
Half an hour later, she tied her horse, saddled this time, to one of the white front porch columns. With the dewy grass still plastered to her black boots, she strode into the parlor and began pounding on the grand piano to awaken the family for breakfast, which the slaves, moving everywhere on tiptoe, were leisurely preparing. Jeff knew the Jackmans lived in a two-story house because for days he had heard people walking around upstairs in the room over his head. Apparently, they lived on a plantation. Looking out the window, he saw acres and acres of green corn stretching back to the woods. His gaze traveling curiously about the room, he saw that somebody had brought him books to read, leaving them on the heavy walnut dresser within easy reach of his hand. Jeff leaned across the bed, reading their titles. There was G.P.R. James's History of Chivalry, two novels by Sir Walter Scott, two border novels, Guy Rivers and the Yemisee by William Gilmore Sims, and an old copy of Harper's Weekly. He heard kitchen utensils rattling and smelled food cooking. Later, Hannah brought him a fine breakfast, complete with a napkin on a tray. But he ate very little of it. He had completely lost his appetite. With nothing better to do, Jeff listened to the conversation of the family at breakfast across the hall. All Miss Jill and Miss Janice talked about were their two beaux in the weighty branch of the Confederate service. To his surprise, they seemed proud of it, as though it were the cavalier branch of the whole rebel army in the Indian country, and being privileged to belong to it was some special honor. He remembered that the Washburn family's menfolk had also gone into one of the weighty regiments, and that the Washburn women had seemed proud of it, too. He was puzzled. The Jackmans, like the Washburns, appeared to be intelligent, respectable, Christian people with a high reputation in the country. He couldn't understand why they wanted their husbands, sons, and brothers to serve under a leader whose followers raided as barbarously as did the weighty men. He was surprised 2 days later to see Miss Janice and Miss Pat walking about the house wearing hoop skirts and carrying books on their heads. And when the books on Miss Pat's head fell with a heavy crash to the hall floor, Hannah, who was cleaning Jeff's room, threw up her black arms in resignation.
"Dat Miss Pat done it again," the big negress moaned. "She never gonna learn to walk graceful like a lady."
Jeff soon learned that in the Jackman home, everything possible was done to teach the girls good breeding. They had to learn to sing, dance, play the piano, ride horseback, read the classics, and flirt with boys without seeming forward or immodest. They were taught how to be good hostesses and how to manage a home, but they rarely did any actual cooking or sewing or cleaning. Apparently, that was reserved for the slaves. Jeff wondered what kind of social training would have been imposed upon sons had the Jackman family had any. One morning, a rebel courier trotted up to the front porch and talked for a few minutes with Mrs. Jackman. Then he rode off at a gallop, refusing her invitation to dine with them. A somber change came over the entire family. There were long conversations in the parlor, and a worried look appeared on Mrs. Jackman's face. Jeff soon found out from Hannah, the newsbringer, what it was. They were going to leave the big house and go south to live for the duration of the war. With Blunt's Union Army prowling about so closely, it was the safest thing to do.
"And we ain't going as refugees either," she said proudly.
She explained that Mr. Jackman, an adjutant in one of the weighty regiments, had rented a plantation near Bonham, Texas, just south of Red River, and was sending the family, their slaves, and his herd of cattle there in style. For days the Jackman women and the slaves packed supplies and personal belongings in several big tar-hubbed wagons for the long trip south. They were even taking Marjorie's grand piano. Already it was lying on its side in one of the wagons, heavily buttressed by hams from the smoke houses to keep it from becoming scratched.
"Yo's going with us too, honey," the old colored woman told Jeff. "They's fixed you a pallet in the back of one of the wagons."
"Not if I can help it," thought Jeff, twisting impatiently on the bed. The sooner he could return to the fort and be out of this hospitable rebel family's debt, the easier he would feel. He disliked this sailing under false colors. 2 nights before the Jackmans were due to start south, he decided to make the effort. Fort Gibson couldn't be much more than 30 miles north, and he had been feeling better lately. He waited until everybody had gone to bed and the big house became quiet. Outside he could hear the whippoorwills whistling in the woods. Bracing himself, he sat up, sliding his legs over the side of the bed. He looked out the window toward the barn. He even had his getaway horse picked out, an old Roman-nosed gray that had long since been turned out to pasture because of his age. Jeff knew he would carry him to the fort riding bareback. He took a couple of steps toward his clothes, hanging from a peg on the wall. Instantly, he became so weak and dizzy that he toppled back onto the bed. For nearly 5 minutes he lay there, fuming at his accursed feebleness and gathering strength for another try. It ended even more ingloriously. In the darkness, he lost his balance on the stair leading to his bed and fell flat on his face. Shaken and downcast, he lay on the floor panting. At this rate, he would never get back to the fort. Railing at himself for not having exercised more, he finally crept back to the bed. "Looks like I'm going on a long trip to Texas," he told himself. The Jackmans' final night in their beloved home came all too soon. Everything had been put in readiness for the leave-taking on the morrow. The wagons were loaded, the cattle herded into the family stockade, the small children bathed and put to bed early. Mrs. Jackman and the girls took one last farewell walk about the premises, pausing at the family well to bury their china in the yard. Joel, the aged Negro body servant, dug the hole with a spade, carefully placed the dishes in it, then gently covered them up. Mrs. Jackman was taking with her half a trunkful of the new Confederate paper money. A staunch rebel patriot, she had earlier gone to Little Rock, Arkansas, and exchanged all her gold and $75,000 worth of State of Georgia bonds for the new Confederate paper specie. It was all the money she had in the world. Hers was no halfway loyalty. Resigned to the trip, Jeff pulled up his sheet for the last time in the big southwest bedroom and closed his eyes. When he awoke next morning, the sun was 2 hours high. Blinking uneasily, he realized he had overslept. Everything about the plantation was ominously quiet. He knew Mrs. Jackman had planned to start at daybreak so they could reach the Texas road by nightfall of the second day. Alarmed, he sat bolt upright in bed. Swiftly, he looked out the window into the yard and caught his breath with relief. There sat the 6 tar-hubbed wagons, each packed and ready to go. But there were no teams being hooked into the traces, no jingle of harness from the barn, no bawling of cattle from the stockade. House, barn, corral, stockade, everything was terrifyingly still. From somewhere within the vast silence of the big house, he heard the faint sound of feminine weeping. Now he knew there was trouble of some kind.
"Hannah! Hannah!"
His voice echoed through the silent halls. Soon he heard heavy footsteps approaching. Hannah ambled into the room, despair in her face. A white dish towel clutched in one hand. Her eyes were wet. Sniffing noisily, she kept dabbing at them with the dishcloth.
"De pins come last night," she moaned. "Our slaves has all left us. Everything on de place has been stole. Yankee army sure gonna get us now."
The Pin Indians were Cherokee full-bloods, sympathetic to the Union, who got their name from the fact they wore crossed pins on their coats or hunting shirts as a badge of their order. They had encouraged the Jackman slaves to steal all the stock and run it off toward Fort Scott, Kansas. The stables had been swept clean. Gone were the mule teams that were to pull the heavy wagons to Texas. Gone from the stockade were the cattle. The thieves had even stolen the pet saddle horses the girls were planning to ride to Texas. There sat the 6 loaded wagons all ready to roll, and not a hoof on the place to turn a wheel. And all the men were off at war. Dry-eyed, Mrs. Jackman wasn't giving up.
"There's no use of our fretting about it, Mr. Bussy," she said practically. "The milk is on the floor, but I've got to think of some way to get our wagons and our family to Texas."
She looked at him expectantly. Behind her stood Miss Pat, red-eyed and inconsolable. The thieves had taken Barney. She had raised him from a colt. No other hand besides hers had ever fed him.
"Ma'am, haven't you got some old worn-out stock somewhere on the place that you could use to pull the wagons?"
Forgetting the war, Jeff wanted desperately to help them.
"If you went slowly, you might get through. With so much stealing going on, the families with the sorriest teams might have the best chance to make it. Nobody would want to steal any broken-down stock."
Mrs. Jackman decided to try it. She and Miss Pat walked out on the range and found several old horses, 2 sick oxen, and a lame mule the deserting slaves had considered too worthless to steal. Old Joel helped Jeff put on his clothing and assisted him to the rear wagon. He felt faint after all the exercise, and lay down on a pallet that had been fixed for him, his head aching dully. At this rate, he would never get to Fort Gibson. It was hot in the wagon despite its canvas top, much hotter than in the house. With a final look at her beloved home, Mrs. Jackman, in the front wagon, shook out her lines and clucked to her team. The caravan began slowly to move. The long trip was pure torture to Jeff. Mile after mile he lay helpless, eating the thick dust and listening to the creak and groan of the wheels. The wheels lurched, jostling him cruelly. When Mrs. Jackman bought some oxen from a settler living along the trail, replacing their worn-out stock, their progress became faster. Swinging around the San Bois Mountains, they came out on the Texas road. The big thoroughfare was crowded that summer with wagons of Cherokee families going south to Red River to live near their menfolk for the war's duration. Jeff's malaria returned. His weight shrank. The Jackmans dosed him with everything, from a tonic they made of wild cherry and dogwood bark to a vial of quinine they secured from the apothecary at Boggy Depot. When the long trip finally stopped deep in the Choctaw country, he felt he never wanted to ride in a wagon again. The journey ended unexpectedly one night at a deserted log house a quarter mile off the road, where they stopped to rest. They found a large garden, neatly weeded, and an orchard, heavily laden with late peaches and early apples. There were a barn and several outbuildings, even a cool spring and a cellar close by.
"Why don't you move in?" a neighbor family advised. "You'll like it here. The Choctaws and Texas people are wonderful. They opened their corn cribs to us and helped us with our crops. The winters here aren't severe. Spring comes much earlier than at home, and it's safe. General Cooper's army usually winters at Fort Washita close by."
Despite her husband's earlier arrangements for them to live in Texas, Mrs. Jackman sent word to him they had decided to stay here for the present. With all their slaves and cattle gone, they wouldn't need a large place anyhow. With the help of their neighbors, the wagons were unloaded, and the family moved in. Jeff was installed in a small shed room south of the house, overlooking the Texas road. It was a much different life from the one they had led in their luxurious 2-story manor back near Briartown. Still too weak to help with the farm work, Jeff could only give directions. The women borrowed a small walking plow and, hitching one of the oxen to it, planted late corn and black-eyed peas. They worked all day in the field. The cinch bugs devoured nearly everybody else's corn, but not the Jackmans.
"Everybody says our rows are so crooked the bugs can't find our corn," Jill laughed one night when she brought Jeff his supper.
Talk was always about the war. Stan Wade's name was on everybody's lips. The whole rebel country seemed to lean on him. Jeff was surprised to learn that he had been elected principal chief of the southern segment of the Cherokees, and it was his responsibility to feed the destitute refugee families camped in the Choctaw country. Under his direction, the Confederate government furnished the refugees corn, wheat, molasses, and sugar when they were available from the rebel supply center at Boggy Depot. The Jackman women went there quite often for their supplies.
Hour after hour, Jeff lay on his stomach, watching the traffic go by on the Texas road.
It increased so greatly in August of 63 that he knew another battle was looming. Company after company of marching rebel infantry and dusty rebel cavalry, accompanied by supply trains, ammunition wagons, and large droves of sheep and long-horned cattle and small Mexican mules, came up from Texas, bound for the north. The southern refugee women living all along the road saw the grim preparations too, and with mounting dread thought of their fathers, brothers, and sweethearts. When news came in late August of the defeat of the rebel General Steele at Perryville, 50 miles north of Boggy Depot, the women waited in fear for the mounted runner Wade always sent south with the casualty reports. When Jeff heard the battle tidings, he found his emotions queerly divided. He was secretly elated at the Union's success, and yet he didn't want the Jackmans hurt by it. He was the one who first saw the rebel cavalryman turn into the Jackman driveway 4 days after the battle. It was an hour before dusk. The lone rider came trotting in from the north. He was gaunt and dirty. The buckskin horse he rode looked sweaty and hot. The Jackman women had just come in from working in the garden. Janice saw the rider as she was bathing her face at the spring.
"Look, Mama,"
she gasped and covered her mouth with her hand. They stood in a little cluster at the well, watching him ride up, a strange fascination in their faces, an odd paralysis in their legs. His horse shied nervously at the chickens, and growling something unintelligible, the rider pulled rein about 20 feet away.
"Is this the Jackman home?" His brown, whiskery face looked like a weed-grown field.
Mutely, the women nodded.
"Does a Mrs. Sophie Chavis live here?"
With a little cry of anguish, Sophie shrank back against the clapboard shed. Mrs. Jackman and Marjorie moved quickly to her side.
"I've bad news, ma'am. Your husband, Thomas Chavis, was killed in the Battle of Perryville. We didn't recover his body, ma'am. We was retreating too fast. The feds will probably bury it, ma'am."
Thus did the war serve the women on both sides. There were happier times, too. One afternoon in early September, Mr. Jackman rode into the yard for his first visit since the family had arrived in the Choctaw country. Deliriously happy, his daughters hurled themselves upon him, hugging him joyfully.
"Stir around, Hannah, and help get something to eat, but only the Lord knows what it will be,"
Mrs. Jackman called to Black Hannah. Then turning to her husband, she embraced him, saying,
"Why didn't you ring a bell or blow a horn and let us know you were coming?"
After dinner was over and the girls had related all the exciting details of their flight by wagon from Briartown to the Choctaw country, they brought their father to see Jeff. He was a small, ragged, black-haired man with a drooping mustache. Soberly, he told of the Confederate defeats at Vicksburg and Gettysburg in the east, and at Perryville and Fort Smith in their own theater of the war, about the terrific raid of desertion among Cabell's Arkansas troops, and of the rebels' appalling lack of arms, clothing, medicine, and shoes. With the Mississippi River patrolled by Union gunboats, the hard-pressed Confederate government at Richmond couldn't supply their westernmost forces in the Indian country. And then he told them something that made Jeff's heart jump like a quail exploding from a grass clump.
"I think we'll do much better in the spring," Jackman added hopefully. "We've been getting a few new repeating rifles smuggled in from the north. Stan thinks he's worked out a way to get hundreds more. This rifle shoots 7 times without reloading. It's lighter and more than a foot shorter than our muzzle loaders. After you shoot, you crank a lever under the trigger. It opens the breech, kicks out the empty cartridge, pumps in a new cartridge, and you're ready to shoot again, all in the flash of a second."
A panic came over Jeff as he heard Orff's new Spencer repeater described in such exact detail. Any rebel cavalry force equipped with a rifle like that would have a tremendous advantage. Might lengthen the war 5 years, or even bring the Union to its knees in this far-off western sphere. He knew he must stay longer in the rebel country. If the rebels were getting repeating rifles from some place in the north, it was his job to find out where they were coming from and stop it, if he could. But how was he going to, lying flat on his back in the Choctaw country nearly 100 miles below Fort Gibson? In late September, he got his appetite back suddenly. One afternoon, Miss Pat brought him a piece of hot, dried fruit pie made from the apples the women had sun-dried. As she held it out, tempting him, Jeff could smell the spicy odor of the nutmeg and the hot, brown juice. To his surprise, the smell didn't sicken him. He gulped the pie down so hungrily that the girl ran excitedly to the house to tell the others. That night, Aunt Hetty Sloan came to sit up with Jeff, much to his disgust. Tall and stern, she was famous as a local humanitarian. She lived on Yarberry Creek, 1.5 miles west of the Jackmans. She wore her gray hair roached upward in a strange-looking topknot, into which she had thrust a tiny jeweled comb. Tiptoeing in, she seated herself decorously by his bed. Adjusting a faded green shawl about her thin shoulders, she leaned forward, staring long and soulfully at him. Then she wrinkled her long, high-bridged nose at Mrs. Jackman and shook her head.
"He looks bad, Maggie," Aunt Hetty whined. "I don't like his color at all. It's chalky. He looks just like my Uncle Jeremiah did before he joined the Great Majority 2 years ago."
Startled by her ghastly diagnosis, Jeff blinked.
"Ma'am, honestly, I feel better today than I've felt in weeks."
Aunt Hetty paid no attention. Shaking her gray head sorrowfully, she sighed.
"Uncle Jeremiah rallied like that, too. It's what we used to call the false recovery. Everybody thought he was bucking up. 3 hours later, he commenced picking at the covers. We buried him up on Cowskin Prairie."
When they had gone, Jeff broke out in a cold sweat of fear. Having no desire to emulate Aunt Hetty's Uncle Jeremiah and jine the Great Majority, he sat up on the side of the bed. His head felt almost normal. The hot fruit pie he had eaten seemed to have given him strength. With growing excitement, he stood and, leaning against the wall in the darkness, took 6 slow, halting steps to the door. He felt no dizziness, no headaches. Elated, he wanted to shout with joy. 3 weeks later, he was able to help Mrs. Jackman and Jill sow wheat in the field. He knew he would be expected to rejoin the rebel outfit. Then Adair, who was now a colonel, sent word he need not report back until spring, since Wadey had furloughed most of his men and sent them home to assist their families with the crops. So Jeff stayed that winter with the Jackmans, helping with the farm work and slowly recovering his strength. He was eager to find out more about the new rifles and hoped that Mr. Jackman, on one of his visits home, might reveal more information. In this, he was doomed to disappointment. Wadey's adjutant never mentioned the subject again. Even so, Jeff was glad to be at the Jackmans instead of at Wadey's winter quarters at Camp Starvation. There the heavy fall rains had left the road so impassable that the men were subsisting upon small rations of parched corn and poorly dried beef and feeding their horses mulberry brush and tree bark. Early in March, Jeff walked to the door of his shed room and looked out into the darkness on the Texas road. The cool air was invigorating. A small bobbing light glimmered far to the south, and Jeff could hear the faint clatter of a string of empty freight wagons hitched together and drawn by mules. He took a long pull of the night air, and his nostrils caught the wild, sweet whiff of plum tree blossoms. He knew that spring was coming fast to the Choctaw country, much faster than back home in his native Kansas. Already the bur oaks were wearing light green tassels, and the red buds' purplish blooms brightened the hillsides and valleys. The robins had stayed around all winter. Jeff felt a surge of renewed hope. It would soon be time to plow. Chapter 21 Boggy Depot. Jeff sat in the afternoon sunshine, his back against the wheel of the commissary wagon, watching Heifer make sourdough biscuits. It was the second day after he had rejoined the Wadey Brigade. He had tried to help Heifer unload and rustle the firewood, but the cook wouldn't let him lift a finger until he got stronger. Now Heifer was pinching off pieces of the white dough. Rolling them into balls between his palms, he placed them in the Dutch oven, turning them in the hot grease so that all sides received a coating and they wouldn't stick together. As he worked, he hummed snatches of songs to himself. When Heifer hummed, his sobbing, quavering voice sounded like one of Cooper's squeaky baggage wagons making a sharp turn in the road on an early frosty morning. And yet Jeff had no difficulty recognizing the tune. Today, it was Heifer's favorite, the religious hymn, Amazing Grace. Watching him, Jeff was ashamed. Everybody in the rebel country had been nice to him. Heifer watched over him like a fussy old hen over a single chick. The Jackmans had taken wonderful care of him. The rebel riders had been good to him since he got back. Disturbed by all their kindness, Jeff felt mean about being against them in the war. With a sweet gush of sorrow, he remembered leaving the Jackmans yesterday. Heifer had come for him in the commissary wagon, a small gray mare trotting behind. All the Jackmans had gathered in the front yard to kiss Jeff goodbye. He thanked them as humbly and gratefully as he knew how for all they had done for him. They seemed genuinely sorry to see him go. Miss Sophie even cried. Heifer's cowhorn mustache looked a little shaggier and grayer, but otherwise he seemed the same. Mrs. Jackman had heard of him through her husband. She urged him to stay for supper.
"Can't, ma'am," Heifer replied in his broken speech. "Gotta be getting back and fixing my own supper for the boys. But here's something anyhow for your supper."
And groping in the back of the wagon, he pulled out a middling of bacon and half a sack of wheat flour.
"The hoss is for you, kid. Got her from my forage camp down Texas. Name's Fleabite."
Jeff looked for the first time at the small mare, daintily cropping the Bermuda greening along the Jackman driveway. She was more cream-colored than gray, with small brown freckles all over her trim young body. Enchanted, Jeff felt the thrill of ownership. He liked her looks. She was sleek and lean. There was a saddle on her back, a small tan Fraser, with narrow stirrups bound in shiny brass. Jeff gulped.
"Corn, Mr. Hobbs. Thank you for finding her for me."
Heifer beamed happily. His distorted face seemed more frightening than ever when it was registering joy or pleasure. Jeff saw Miss Pat big-eyeing the mare longingly. He felt sorry for her. He knew she hadn't straddled a horse since her beloved Barney had been stolen by the Pins. Since then, the girl's only contact with stock had been driving an ox to the walking plow they sometimes borrowed from a Choctaw neighbor. Jeff walked to the back of the commissary wagon, untied the bridle reins, and held them out to her.
"Here,
he said. Why don't you take a gallop on her while I go pack my things?
He liked the way her eyes suddenly grew big and round and starry.
Oh, thank you,
she breathed. Quickly, she tied the reins to the wagon wheel. Squealing with delight, she raced to the house to find her riding habit. Later, when it was time to go, Jeff couldn't wait himself to ride the mare. Putting his foot in the stirrup, he went up on one side of her and came down on the other in a heap. Heifer catching him with one arm just in time. He still wasn't entirely over his dizziness. He felt silly, folding up like that in front of everybody. He rode off, seated in the back of the commissary wagon, where he could lead the mare and look at her. Now, Heifer was lifting the lids of other Dutch ovens and turning the beefsteaks in them. The ovens were deep iron skillets, with three small legs and a heavy lid with an upturned lip so the hot lid could be picked up with a gouge hook. There were red coals of fire on top of each lid as well as underneath the oven. The rebel cook certainly knew how to revive a bulky appetite. Yesterday he had taken a shotgun and, riding out into the brush, killed two fat quail, frying them for Jeff in the Dutch oven. From the sack of dried apples the Jackmans had given them, he made a pie. Rolling out the dough with a whiskey bottle and cutting the initials CMR for Cherokee Mounted Rifles in the top crust with his bowie knife. The brigade had seemed glad to see Jeff back, too. One shaggy fellow brought him four hen's eggs. Even Fields welcomed him with a stiff handshake. The sergeant wore his campaign coat buttoned neatly in front. His shoulder seemed entirely healed.
"Heard you been laying sick. Too bad. Glad you're back."
Again, Jeff felt the prickings of his stubborn conscience. He almost wished they weren't so good to him. A week later, the whole outfit moved north 15 miles toward Boggy Depot. Gorging himself on Heifer's cooking, Jeff was feeling fine. He rode Flea Bite alongside the commissary wagon. They splashed across a creek with clay-colored water and white haw blossoms blooming along its banks. He heard the redbirds whistling, and they reminded him of home. The sun penetrated warmly through his old coat. Spring was on the way. When they first saw Boggy Depot, it was late afternoon. In the sun's flat rays, the rebel war capital looked like a handful of clods on a muddy creek bank. But as they rode closer, Jeff saw with surprise that the town sprawled all over the woodsy flat. It had been built in the edge of the woods. Stumps of trees protruded in the streets, and patches of native live oak and hickory remained undisturbed in the very heart of the town. It was an hour before sundown when they jogged into its outskirts. After helping Heifer set up in the military zone at the town's south edge, Jeff and Hooley Pogue rode down the middle of Main Street. They drew rein at the public well, and at the top of a crude flagpole, Jeff saw something that startled him, something he had never seen before. It was a ragged rectangle of gray and blue bunting. Two red bars crossed each other in the middle, with a few white stars sewn crudely between them. He realized it was a homemade rebel flag. He felt vaguely displeased. Compared to his own beloved stars and stripes, it seemed cheap and bold and arrogant. And yet it made him feel a little alarmed. If the rebellion against his country had reached the point where the enemy now had a flag as well as a president, a congress, and an army, no wonder the war had lasted 3 years. These people were fighting for something they believed in. They might be hard to subdue. Suddenly a cannon boomed loudly from behind them. Flea Bite jumped nervously. A troop of ragged Indian cavalry raced down the street on their small ponies, war whooping shrilly and brandishing their stone tomahawks. They galloped round and round the flagpole, singing loudly and fiercely something that sounded like Yakawela, Hikanahi. Mystified, Jeff turned to Hooley. Who are they? Hooley's lip curled scornfully. Choctaws and Chickasaws singing the Choctaw war song. They always sing it when the sunset gun goes off. If they could fight as good as they can sing. Jeff remembered these same Indian troops, riding blithely into the Battle of Honey Springs armed only with archaic weapons. He didn't think Hooley was being entirely fair to the Choctaws. They didn't have much to fight with. Maybe if they had been armed decently and trained intelligently, they could have fought as well as anybody. When Jeff and Hooley returned to camp, hundreds of Indian soldiers were hobbling their horses and cooking their suppers over campfires. Hooley led Jeff on a tour, and he saw from close range how the weighty men lived during their spare time. Cheers and shouts came from one of the few cleared spots where the long grass had been trampled down. Men armed with hickory switches were flailing each other about the legs and hips with howls of mingled pain and laughter. Hooley said the game was called Hot Jackets. They wandered here and there, encountering teamsters repairing sets of heavy harness and greasing them with tallow and neat's foot oil. Troopers were sharpening their long, fierce-looking knives on blue whetstones, or cleaning shotguns and horse pistols, or erecting torn dog tents amid the trees. Many were writing letters, using poke berries for ink and sharpened corn stalks for pens. Moving on, they heard the distant sound of banjo music and of feet stamping the grassy ground in rhythm. They hurried closer and saw, seated on a bodark stump, a gangling, long-armed rebel banjo player. Dirty hands flying, he was strumming the merriest, rowdiest music Jeff had ever heard. Listening to it, his feet itched, and he almost felt compelled to join the other weighty men who were grasping each other around the waist and, with shrill cries and yells, stomping about the leaf-strewn ground, hoedown style. Hooley told Jeff the name of the lively tune was Billy in the Low Grounds. Like everything else in the rebel country, the banjo was homemade, with a drum head nailed tightly over half a whiskey keg and its five long strings fastened with small staples. "War's shoot!" somebody yelled. A roar went up, and Jeff saw Adair, the long-haired colonel who had questioned him and Bostwick, standing in the crowd, a smile on his handsome face. Then the crowd pushed Schott out into the open space. A bashful, ragged little man, he held back and shook his head in refusal until somebody held out a green bottle toward him, whereupon he seemed suddenly to lose all his reluctance. Reaching, he swallowed deeply and, so enlivened, jumped beside the banjoist who, throttling down the volume on his instrument, began softly picking a warm, racy tune called Blind Coon Dog. Schott began to pat his foot, snap his fingers, and sway rhythmically from side to side. Suddenly he grasped his chin with one hand and began to make with his teeth sharp clicking noises that sounded like bones rattling, keeping perfect time to the lively music. His performance was received with deafening applause. Several of the listeners were so delighted they rolled on the ground with laughter. An hour after dark, a small troop of heavily armed Cherokee cavalry rode into camp from the Fort Townsend Road. Jeff was on night sentry duty. Fields strolled out to meet them.
"Bessie," he ordered, "take Major Boudinot to headquarters. He wants to see Colonel Wadey."
"Yes, sir," said Jeff, saluting. With a tiny shiver of excitement, he thought that he, too, would like to see the infamous rebel cavalry leader. Boudinot, the man Jeff was escorting, was an important-looking fellow, with high cheekbones and long black hair that was visible beneath his black, flat-crowned hat. He carried two bulging saddlebags. Jeff led him to a brown Sibley tent pitched beneath a grove of locusts. Fields had told him it was headquarters. But the tent was dark, and all Jeff found was an old man asleep on a quilt spread outside on the ground. A small campfire glowed nearby. Either Wadey was absent, or Jeff had the wrong tent. Reaching down, he shook the old man by the shoulder.
"Excuse me, sir," Jeff said, "but can you tell me where we can find Colonel Wadey?"
The man sat up instantly, his grayish, long-cropped hair tumbling to his collar.
"I'm Colonel Wadey. What do you want?"
His low-pitched voice was quiet, courteous, dignified. He wore a knife and pistol in his belt. Jeff's jaw flopped open. The man had no bodyguard of any kind. Recovering fast, he clicked both heels together and saluted.
"Sir, a gentleman is here to see you."
With his musket, Jeff indicated Boudinot. Wadey rolled to his feet with a lithe, cat-like motion that would have done credit to a far younger man. Now that the firelight glimmered squarely on him, Jeff saw that he was a little, dark-skinned Indian with a square face and a flat nose. He looked more like a full-blood than a mixed blood. Jeff was never so disappointed in his life. He had always imagined Wadey to be a big, sinister fellow. Instead, he looked like some gentle old Indian farmer taking a noonday nap under a tree. Recognizing his guest, Wadey exclaimed cordially,
"Cornelius,"
and extending both hands stepped forward to greet his visitor.
"Uncle!"
Boudinot's voice was equally cordial, his pearly white teeth flashing in the firelight. Boudinot smiled again, and Wadey went inside the tent. Jeff heard the scratch of a match and smelled the acrid sulfur burning. Limping slightly beneath the weight of his saddlebags, Boudinot followed. Jeff stood rooted to the spot, staring after them. Boudinot's high, melodious voice carried outside the tent. He spoke with obvious pride.
"Uncle, I got the nation an appropriation of $100,000. I brought $45,000 of it back with me. Scott, the Confederate commissioner, is bringing the rest out in July."
Jeff heard Wadey grunt with satisfaction.
"Did you bring the gold?"
Boudinot was faintly apologetic.
"Only $12,000 of an uncle. Richmond could give me only $4,000. I've been weeks scraping up the rest from our people living up and down Red River. Why do you need gold?"
Deciding he'd better get back on duty, Jeff shouldered his musket and started to move off.
"To buy rifles with. New repeating rifles. A Fed officer at Fort Gibson is smuggling them to us from St. Louis. They're 7-shot Spencers, and if we had enough of 'em, we could shorten the war fast out here, but they're expensive. I have to pay $50 in gold for each gun and $30 a thousand for 52 caliber copper cartridges. The Fed officer won't take nothing but gold."
Jeff froze in his tracks.
"Who is he?"
Boudinot asked the question inside the tent just as Jeff himself wanted to ask it, standing breathless in the dusk outside. Wadey's grunt sounded half sarcastic, half amused.
"He's no fool, nephew. He's not going to tell us his name. When we pay him off, he always stands in the dark so we can't see his face. He's got a gang of Fed soldiers working for him. When the guns arrive at Gibson, he lets us know. He sold us a dozen that way last July. They said he'd have 500 more this summer. Only I can't buy 500. With only $12,000 in gold, I can buy only 200 with cartridges."
Outside, Jeff drew a long breath into his lungs. Who could the Union officer be? First he thought of Orff, who already had one of the guns. Then his mind went thrusting back to Clardy. However, Clardy had such a violent dislike for everything Confederate that he'd never approach a rebel without shooting first. He'd surely never do business with one. Jeff swallowed. It was probably somebody he didn't even know. There were hundreds of officers at Fort Gibson. Boudinot's voice grew soft with cunning.
"Uncle, why buy the guns at all? Why don't you just take them?"
"Because we need 1,000 rifles, not 200. With 1,000 repeating rifles, I could crucify their supply trains by land or water, starve them out of Fort Gibson, and win back all our old country north of the Arkansas, so our people could return to their homes in peace. If I take these 200 rifles without paying, that's all we'd get. He wouldn't bring us any more."
Jeff was astounded at what he had heard. If he knew the name of the federal officer who was peddling the contraband rifles, he could leave for Fort Gibson tonight. Once Fort Gibson knew the betrayer's name, he could be watched, trapped, and taken. Otherwise, it would be hard to trace him. Cautiously, he began backing through the brush. The talking ceased abruptly. One of the shadows inside the tent moved with monstrous unnaturalness.